May 26, 1993, interview with Dr. Constantine Mengus.
Well, Dr. Mengus, my first question though is really what was the overall Reagan administration policy towards Cuba? Was there going to be a change of this continuity that had been going on since 62? Was it going to be a radical change? What?
An interview on May 26, 1993 with Ms. Antonia de la Cova concerning the Reagan administration and Cuba. And the question was there going to be a change?
Right. What was the overall Reagan policy? As you know, the Cuban exile community was believing that Reagan was going to get rid of Castro immediately, or was going to invade Cuba, or take a lot more stronger action than the Carter administration had done.
Of course, you remember that Secretary of State Haig gave all the speeches about going to the source if the Cuban and Soviet support for the Central American Communist guerrilla didn't stop. So that there was, Haig, I think, raised expectations of strong action directly against the Castro regime through those speeches in the spring of 1981. However, what in fact was done was to conduct a months-long policy review of what U.S. policy toward Cuba and toward the entire sort of communist threat in Central America and the Latin American region should be. And the ultimate decision, ultimate outcome of that was an approach that emphasized maintaining the isolation of Castro, political isolation of Castro, and economic isolation of Castro intact, on the one hand, while moving more actively to help those opposing Cuban-supported regimes and military forces to defeat those efforts. That meant specifically in Nicaragua, starting to help the armed resistance against the Cuban-supported communist government in Nicaragua, helping the friendly governments in Central America defend themselves against the Cuban and Soviet-supported communist insurgencies, also moving toward more active means of dealing with some of the Cuban activities abroad. By the time that Reagan came to office, there were 70,000 Cuban military and secret police personnel abroad, supporting a number of pro-Soviet regimes. And I would say that the increase in the help to the Afghan anti-communist resistance was also a general part of the effort at sort of turning back the tide of communist success.
Okay, now, Roger Fontaine had said in the summer of 1980 that the Reagan administration, if it came to power and Reagan won the election, that they would have to take a closer look at this Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement that had tied the hands of the United States in dealing with Cuba. Have you ever seen this agreement, or can you give me a description of this agreement? I know there's a lot of theories going on out there, but what was your general impression, what this agreement consisted of?
Well, the general terms have been discussed publicly, and that is that in return for two things that Castro promised and that were part of Kennedy's statement of November 20th, 1962, in return for the removal of offensive weapons from Cuba and for the ending of armed subversion against countries in the by the Castro regime, the United States promised not to attack Cuba militarily in order to undo the Castro regime, not to openly invade Cuba. So that was the essential.
But Castro, I believe in reading the letters that were exchanged, because Secretary of State Cyrus Vance was asked in 1979 to describe this, and he basically said that the agreement was really consisted of the 25 letters that were exchanged, the secret correspondence of talks between the Soviet diplomats and the administration, that there was really a whole lot of things that made up this agreement. And if I recall correctly, when Kennedy, in one of the letters, asked Khrushchev to have Castro abide by this of not fomenting subversion in Latin America, that Khrushchev said, well, those are Cuban internal matters we can't interfere with or can't make him stop doing it. And that was one of the issues that was really left kind of hanging in the air that was never really agreed to. Castro was very hostile to even having the missiles pulled out, to any type of secret agreement. And but why would the Reagan administration abide by this?
Well, I think U.S. administrations tend to abide by agreements reached by previous presidents. I mean, agreements of the United States government tend to continue on to administrations, international agreements. But what the agreement was obviously open to interpretation. I mean, if Secretary of State Vance is talking about a whole complex of letters, papers, negotiations, and the like, then obviously it meant that anybody in the Department of State could interpret the agreement as they chose to do so. I think in broad terms, the most fundamental question was, was the Reagan administration ready to undertake war against Cuba with the risk that this could bring the Soviet Union into war, since the Soviet Union and Cuba have a pact? The answer was no. It wasn't ready to undertake an open war against Castro, risking a thermonuclear war. I personally think that was a good idea, and in fact, I'm the author of an alternative approach, which in a sense, I think, basically was followed, and the alternative approach was to continue the political and economic isolation of the Castro regime, and then also to essentially view the Cuban combat military secret police personnel abroad as Castro's vulnerabilities, and to help those seeking to attack them and to drive them out of their foreign imperial activities, and to drive Castro back from his extended operations internationally, and to deter his future support of armed subversion, terrorism, and guerrilla warfare. And I would say that approach was viewed as more prudent, politically sustainable, and one that ultimately would accomplish the objectives the United States saw without risking thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union.
Is that then the reason why, when Cuban exiles, for example, the veterans of the Bay of Pigs 2506 Brigade, asked the Reagan administration to establish a Cuban Contra program, then is that the reason why the Reagan administration never did, and that Cuban freedom fighters were never given any sort of help like the other freedom fighters in Nicaragua,
yes,
Angola,
yes,
Afghanistan,
yeah,
were?
Yeah, I think that's the reason.
So
the reason was not only the carryover of the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement of 1962, because in my view, I argued that it had no basic validity because Castro had violated the promise not to engage in armed subversion, thereby vitiating the agreement as publicly announced by President Kennedy. Now, Cuban-American scholar Jorge Dominguez, in many debates he and I have had on this, continually says that there never was a public U.S. government statement to the effect that the second element was involved, that is, the ending of armed subversion. I showed him the letter statement in the presidential papers of President Kennedy, in which President Kennedy is very explicit and says there are two parts to the agreement, removal of offensive weapon and ending of armed subversion. But aside from that, even if there had been no Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement, as of 1981, I don't believe the Reagan administration would have move to take that kind of action against Castro in the initial stages of the administration, that it would have been seen as imprudent and risky beyond the strategic interests of the United States. And the better approach was to defeat Castro's allies abroad, defeat Castro abroad, and then close in on Castro through a program that I, again, would have argued would have been primarily political in nature. That is, I strongly urge the establishment of a political resistance movement and the funding on a regular basis of a major effort like Solidarity in Poland, which I viewed as a, shall we say, whichever came first, but the concept of a sort of a large-scale, broad-based, non-violent citizens' resistance to an oppressive communist dictatorship. And I argued for that kind of activity being done as a complement to the defeat of Castro's forces abroad. We never got around to that, partly because there, as I outlined and revealed in my book Inside the National Security Council, published in 1988, the Department of State had a strong faction, absolutely determined to normalize relations with Castro's Cuba, and took every opportunity to try to move the Reagan administration in that direction, to undo President Reagan's policy of support for the armed anti-communist resistance movements everywhere, to establish a second agreement with Nicaragua that would be modeled on the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement, whereby the Sandinistas would be permitted to remain in power indefinitely and could forget their pledge of democratic elections to the Organization of American States for the condition of their recognition by the OAS in 1979, in return for a promise of no armed subversion internationally. That's what the State Department faction was ready to do. And the fact that Castro had violated his agreement for nearly 30 years on that, or 20 years on that score, didn't bother them. And there was a very strong group in the Department of State.
Who was spearheading that group?
Well, spearheading it would Thomas Enders, as the career Foreign Service officer who really didn't know the region at all and immediately took the advice of the career officials whom he inherited in the Latin American Bureau, Craig Johnston and others. I mean, there was a whole group of them, and they just, this was the mindset of the Bureau and of Latin American affairs. This is the way they saw it. This is what they thought made sense. They didn't think President Reagan's policies made sense, and they constantly worked. And then they convinced Enders convinced Haig. Haig resigned. Schultz came in, the same group convinced Schultz. Schultz took that as his policy and opposed the president in ways I outlined in my book again and again on these mm-hmm. issues. So in fact, keeping any semblance of a Reagan policy on track was an enormous struggle in the Reagan administration, because the whole policy process at the Department of State was in the hands of career Foreign Service officials.
But then again, Enders himself was replaced, and yet there was
no change
in policy towards Cuba.
He was replaced in May 1983. In fact, we're almost at the anniversary of his replacement. Mr. Langhorne Motley was brought in, a real estate salesman from Alaska who had grown up in Brazil and spoke Portuguese, and had been a credible ambassador to Brazil for 2 years, who was brought in and kept all of the deputy assistant secretaries from the Hague, from the Enders time, and in fact simply took on the policy and went at it again, which was Schultz's policy, stayed with the Schultz Latin American Bureau policy versus the President Reagan's policy, and was extraordinarily, my view, misguided in his activities. And then, as you know, 2 years later, he was replaced also in 1985 for this reason. And both Enders and Motley were replaced ultimately because their actions against the president's policy came to the president's attention and led to their removal. But, you know, in the meantime, this huge internal struggle within the executive branch, which I did chronicle in the book Inside the NSC, was one in which you had simply two different views of international political reality and what was in the U.S. interest. The State Department view was one, and Reagan's decisions were another.
So basically then, the Reagan administration never even thought about establishing any type of Cuba Contra program or any type of aid to Cuban exiles.
Yes,
aid to Cuban exiles to carry out any type of guerrilla war against Castro.
Members of the Reagan administration did think about it, and it was considered as one of the possibilities, and was rejected
by the president.
No, well, I'd say it was, no, I don't think it got to the president. I don't think it was ever put to the president as an option. I think it was rejected below the level of the president as simply being too risky, too dangerous for the purpose to be achieved.
But these Q and Exile groups were addressing...
to succeed.
Right, but they were addressing the president himself, and I know these letters were sent to him by the Brigade 2506, etc. So, I mean, he was aware that this is what the Cuban exiles wanted to do.
Oh, but I wouldn't bet on that at all. I mean, I've seen letters from 30 congressmen and senators never get to the president. No, what gets to the president is a very open question. You never know. And I wouldn't know whether those letters ever received, whether it reached him. But I was a member of the policy group that did consider the Cuba Central America policy in some depth, and I was the representative of one major institution. And there was a consideration of that, and it was simply viewed as not prudent or practical.
Because in 1983 and again in 1985, newsman Tomás Regalado interviewed the president for his radio program, and on both occasions asked him to denounce and abrogate the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement, yet the president refused to do so. You know, he said that he felt that it should not be touched, that it should stay as it was. Why do you feel he took that attitude?
Because the Soviet Union was, as you may recall, engaged in a massive strategic military buildup as well as a conventional buildup, and was very, very hostile. Was deploying thousands of hydrogen bombs on medium-range missiles in Europe, and I think the president's view would have been that to denounce the agreement would open the way to the establishment of offensive nuclear weapons on Cuban territory, which would lead to the United States being at a great disadvantage strategically, or the need to do something, which again risks thermonuclear war. And you should remember that the Soviet Union was making threats on a regular basis in 1982, 1983
on the SS-20
of deployment if the United States should dare to match the medium-range missile deployment in Europe that was scheduled for November 1983. And those threats from the Soviet Union grew louder and louder and more, of greater concern. So the idea of denouncing, and that of course had something to do with Grenada and some of the other things, so the idea of denouncing the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement would not have seemed in the interest of the United States, since it would have freed the Soviet Union to then say, if the agreement no longer exists, we'll put hydrogen bombs on Cuban soil.
So you feel that then that's why, that the president thought that that was a real possibility, that the Soviets could have reintroduced nuclear weapons
they
into Cuba?
They kept saying they were thinking of doing that. They were going...
They're talking about Europe, though.
No. They kept threatening through a number of variety of means, which I mentioned inside the NSC, to make analogous deployments. That is, if we're going to move nuclear weapons or medium-range missiles so close to them, they were worried about the 10-minute flight time. They wouldn't have warning for the whole command and control evacuation and so forth. So they didn't like Moscow being destroyed, that Moscow could be destroyed in 10 minutes. And they kept saying that they would do something analogous if we did that. And analogous could mean Cuba, Nicaragua, or Grenada, in terms of three places over which they had control. And so it was, shall we say, and this was taken seriously. The Soviet Union was both much more powerful relative to the United States in 1982 and 83 than it was in 1962. Much more, by a factor of, by many, many factors.
Now, it also seems that the Reagan administration had also expanded the policy of the Carter administration regarding Cuba as far as promoting and increasing these exchanges of sports team, education, cultural exchanges. The policy seemed to have been more continuity and not any type of abrupt change, even in that perspective.
Now, I don't have much feeling for that, I have to say. I don't. I think for most of us who are dealing with issues of war and peace and life and death, we were not really much involved with that, those issues of exchange programs and so forth. But I really don't know what happened, and I don't know what the previous policies were, and I don't remember it ever being discussed, frankly. So I would guess that means the career bureaucracy of state and USIA and so forth just continue doing whatever they were doing. I don't remember it being an issue ever in discussion.
Okay, another issue here is that the Reagan administration bombed Libya in April of 86 in reprisal for a terrorist attack against the Americans, and one American was killed in Berlin. Yet you had Cuban-sponsored Puerto Rican terrorists murdering American sailors down in Puerto Rico. They were attacking the FBI and the Marshal's offices down there with anti-tank rockets and were setting off bombs in New York City. They robbed $7 million from a Wells Fargo depot in Hartford, Connecticut. And half the money went to Cuba, according even to the Attorney General Edwin Meese at the time. And yet, you know, here we have Castro running, Castro's agents running amok here on U.S. soil, and U.S. has taken no retaliation or reprisal like they did against Libya. Why do you think was the reason for that? And did this at any time come up in any of the NSC meetings with the president or?
When would you say that those activities began?
They continued. As a matter of fact, in 1980, when the Puerto Rican macheteros machine gunned a bus of Navy personnel down there, Reagan at the time, I'm sorry, it was in 79, November 79, Reagan at the time even gave a radio address saying something to the effect that that this is that Cuba was behind this, that they had supplied the weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, I think in 1981, when Reagan was president, the Muniz Air Force Base, the National Guard Air Force Base down in Puerto Rico, was bombed by the macheteros, creating $45 million worth of damage. They put pipe bombs in the turbines of the planes. And they knocked out 11 planes. That was 1981. The 1982, May of 82, is when a U.S. ship that was down there in port in Puerto Rico, two of their sailors were killed, were machine gunned by the Machetero group. The attack on the FBI offices was a week after Grenada. And when the Macheteros put out their communique, they said this is in reprisal for Grenada. And unfortunately, they missed the shot. They hit one floor below. They hit a column. And our magazine down there in Puerto Rico that I was editor of, La Cronica, came out with a headline that said, the gang that couldn't shoot straight strikes again. But, a lot of this terrorist activity was going on all through the early years until the Macheteros were arrested in 1985. And this is when Secretary Meese came out, and even Judge Webster at the time, head of the FBI, came out and said, we know Cuba's linked to this. And yet, you know, we see no reprisal from the Reagan administration.
Well, I think it's, I think there probably are, it may be that because of the number of fronts on which Castro was committing aggressive and hostile acts, that these individuals, sort of the secondary linkage to these acts was sort of not the focus, because in fact...
But this was right on U.S. soil.
I think that's true, but you see, that's part of it, because what happens when it's on U.S. soil is it's the province of the domestic side of the U.S. government. And so the domestic side of the U.S. government undoubtedly treated each one as a police issue and an investigation issue and so forth. And it was not, I don't think it was really considered in the aggregate on the international side of the U.S. government.
Internationally. You're saying then that had Libya done this, had sponsored people do it in the U.S., it would have been a domestic matter.
Well, no, you remember that there was credible evidence of Libya having decided to assassinate Reagan and top member of the cabinet. Right. And that was starting in 82. The attack you mentioned was in 86. Right. So the counter-strike, as I call it, in April 86. So you see the United States government I think the United States government has a hard time dealing with indirect aggression, arms of belligerent, just conceptually, operationally, and legally. I don't think it quite knows what to do when it isn't that, when indirect aggression and violence is used this way, even on its own territory. I think the United States government, what I would say is that I think that Castro was so active and hostile internationally that these activities on U.S. soil, which were then the focus of domestic U.S. agencies, really didn't, in a sense, become a focus of consideration about international reprisal. Not in my time. Okay. And I would say that, by the way, I think that's, again, partly due to the tendency of significant elements of the State Department to always want to downplay everything. I mean, what the State Department people, what a significant faction there would be saying is, well, you see, if we would only normalize relations with Castro, we would have to do this to get our attention. I mean, that would be their analysis. You see, obviously, this is an art case for normalization, not for reprisal. And the few people who would be talking about reprisal, such as myself, would be seen as, well, very kind of extreme. Now, that's the little bit of the culture of the U.S. government that was developing.
Yet another issue here that we see was more or less in the same line, where the Reagan administration didn't take a tough line, was through the Mariel criminals that were in U.S. jails since 1980, where instead of forcibly sending them back, or as Alexander Haig suggested one time, in a ship, an expandable ship, or as Florida Governor Bob Graham said, let's put them in the Guantanamo Naval Base and release them on the other side, or even during the Grenada invasion, the House of Representatives passed a non-binding resolution asking the President to return the Mariel criminals back to Cuba with the prisoners of war. Yet at none of these times did the President take any type of forceful action, and instead, he tried to negotiate an immigration treaty for 7 years to the tune of, costing $40 million to keep these people in prisons and insane asylums. Why did the administration fail to take even a tougher stand in dealing with the return of the Mariel criminals?
I think you have to ask the domestic side. It wasn't an international issue. I mean, that's part of the reality of the U.S. government. I mean, there really is a difference between agencies that are concerned with when things happen on U.S. territory, they're domestic matters. You know, CIA can't even collect information on foreign terrorist activities on U.S. soil. It's totally dependent on the domestic intelligence organization, the FBI, to tell it what's going on. So there is a really strong separation of both perspective, you don't look at what's going on, and of responsibility.
Well, this was from an international perspective when they were trying to negotiate an immigration agreement.
Well, I would say the issue was basically given over to state to handle in a sort of customary diplomatic way, and that's what was done. You see, what you have to understand is that there are only when you have basically a George Shultz who has sort of seeks to dominate all of foreign policy making, who has totally taken the position of the State Department staff of his on virtually every issue.
Right, even when he refused to have him submit to polygraph tests.
Yeah, but on international policy issues, when you have that, and you have then a very small number of sub-cabinet officials, of which I was one. I mean, it was me, Richard Pearl, Roger Robinson on international economic issues. I mean, there were about six or seven or eight of us. And then three cabinet officials, Casey Weinberger, on some issues, Kirkpatrick, when she was involved, but Casey Weinberger. That's it. that's the policymaking network. And there are only so many issues you can take up. So if you're fighting to avoid sort of setbacks through normalization with Castro, setbacks through cutting off the armed resistance in Nicaragua, setbacks through false treaties that Shultz said was going to surprise the president with in October 1984, as the president didn't even know about. When you're fighting to prevent that.
False treaty?
Yeah, false. The Central America Treaty, which would have been a total defeat for all of Reagan's objectives. Mm-hmm. You know, when, so when you're trying to prevent a series of State Department plots in every area, it's true in strategic weapons policy, tactical nuclear weapons, international economic relations, the pipeline, and every one of these, you know, where Haig tells, after the summit with Reagan in 82, where Haig tells the European foreign ministers, that despite Reagan's objection to having them become totally dependent on the Soviets for natural gas and give the Soviets another $15 billion a year in hard currency, don't worry about Reagan's objection, I'll take care of it, just don't worry about it. He tells them. We got him fired, by the way.
That's what got him fired?
That's what got him fired, right. Because he made a mistake of talking on the phone. So I'm told, and then there were transcripts, and then there was shown. So when you have a situation in which the President of the United States has given orders, made decisions, and the Department of State, led by first Haig and then Shultz, on most issues, not all, but on 85%, is fighting the President.
So why?
It's fundamental policy.
Why didn't he fire Shultz?
Because he didn't, I'd say that he didn't know in detail, and I think part of the reason he didn't remember, I was the last Republican foreign policy expert on the NSC once I was gone. My Latin American responsibilities ended in July 85. And once I was gone, from then on, you had all career FSOs and career military officials. You had no more Reagan foreign policy experts. And once that, the president had no independent staff and didn't even know it. He didn't understand the difference. And without an independent staff that could tell him what was really going on, a lot of the other things then could happen. That's the, one of the real challenges of the modern presidency, for the president to know what's going on. We've just seen it with President Clinton, where, you know, I don't believe Clinton approved the whole little, this little plot to get, this travel agency in Arkansas in and to fire these people. He didn't approve that. It wasn't that. He was shown the plan, and he said, oh, that's great, yeah, let's do that, and check it off, yes, I'll do that. He didn't know that. He's done that second level down.
Underlings.
Yeah. And so it's very hard for presidents to know what's going on in the U.S. government, and it's very hard when the Department of State has a view that's contrary. So my point to you is there are only so many issues you can fight. You remember the Radio Martí issue where Jorge Mas gave me the proposal in the spring of 1980. I took it to candidate Reagan. I took it into the Reagan administration. He pushed it. Still took 5 years to get the broadcast done. 5 years, we were ready to go.
But
Radio Martí was ready to go for a good year and a half.
But in 1960, when the administration at the time wanted to get Radio Swan going, they didn't go through the Congress and all to do it, and that came out overnight.
Yeah, but that was a special activity, and the idea of Radio Martí was to establish an open transmission and to establish a normal broadcasting activity, not as a covert function. And so, I think it's right to go propose it to Congress, get the Congress to approve. And so what I'm telling you is that even once the Congress had approved, just because of this group within the executive branch who didn't like the idea, they held it up for 2 years.
It was this State Department group?
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned that in your book. Now, and we'll get to that in a minute. One thing I do want to...
But we've got about 5 minutes more.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Well, okay, could you... you do mention in your book that that Shultz was opposed to Radio Martí from the beginning during one of the meetings that they held at the, I believe it was NSC meeting or something, that he came on saying that all the reasons why Radio Martí shouldn't come out on the air.
Well, I don't remember that now. If I wrote it, then I recall it. But I know that the Department of State was opposed to Radio Martí.
Okay.
And continually, and constantly tried to, and then worked with McFarland to keep it from being considered, getting to the president.
Okay. You mentioned here also that that Enders had excluded in the winter of 1981 Roger Fontaine and General Robert Schweitzer from the meetings.
Right, on Cuba and Central America.
Why was that?
Because they would be more tough-minded and, you know, hard-line.
That Roger Fontaine was going to be more tough-minded?
Yes,
but
he didn't accept the... He was perceived as not accepting, or I would say they probably excluded them simply not to have the National Security Council informed, keep them ignorant, so they couldn't be a complicating factor because they wanted the State Department to dominate the process.
But Fontaine had written a book in 75 on negotiating with Cuba, and he had even been promoting a rapprochement with Cuba.
Well, Tom Enders didn't know that. If he'd known that, maybe he would have invited him in. Now, they excluded them, I'd say, basically on the grounds of simply wanting the State Department to dominate the process. And the best way to do that is just keep the NSC out if you can. And I protested that, as I said. I thought it was unfair to the NSC and unfair to the President.
Okay. Just your book here mentions that at the NSC meeting in late May of 85, in the Situation Room, you said you mentioned you were not present, but you learned that Secretary of State Schultz opened the meeting by giving the reasons why this was not the right time to launch Radio Marti. And the President interrupted Schultz and asked if he was set to go and said to go ahead and do it. So you don't know the reasons why, what reasons he was saying why
no,
wasn't
no,
it?
No, no, no. I didn't recall it.
Okay, one thing that intrigues me about this, and I've always thought that maybe there was a reason for Radio Marti coming out, was that in November 1984, we have the immigration treaty signed with Cuba. So there seems to be a closer rapprochement between the two countries. Now, on January 1st, 1985, Ismael Labit, a murderer from the Virgin Islands that had done a racial murder down there in 72, killed 8 people, hijacks a plane to Cuba. State Department repeatedly asked January, February, March for Cuba to return this guy. And Cuba never returned him. Now, at the same time, Jorge Mas had been saying Radio Marti was going to come out January 28th of 85, and I believe that other people in the government were saying the same thing. Now, the Radio Marti doesn't come out on January 28th, which was Jose Marti's birthday. And I sort of have a feeling that possibly, because his hijacker wasn't returned January, February, March, that this is what speeded up Radio Marti coming out on May 20th of 85. Do you think?
I don't think so. No.
You don't think so?
No, I think the delay was due simply because the significant faction of the executive branch led by the State Department was very nervous about Radio Marti. They were very nervous about Castro's retaliation. They didn't want to take the risk and simply felt this could be put off indefinitely and were willing to do so. And the reason it started is because Jorge Mas got Charlie Wake to get to the President
right,
and tell him, everything's ready, let's go, and the President...
I read that in your book.
Let's go.
But the administration at the time came out with these other plans that if the station would be jammed, there would be surgical strikes against Cuba and jamming stations, etc. And Radio Marti has been jammed now since TV Marti came on the air, so... I don't know. I see it as sort of a moot question now. I did argue with Mr. Wick about that, and we disagreed.
I'm sorry. It's been jammed. Radio Marti has been jammed.
Right. Both TV Marti and Radio Marti is being jammed.
I didn't know that.
Oh, it hasn't gone into Cuba since TV Marti came out.
And when is that?
I think 91.
Okay. Since I didn't know that.
Yes. It's as soon as. As soon as TV Marti came on the air, they started jamming TV Marti, and about 2 weeks later, they jammed Radio Marti. It's been jammed ever since, and my argument with Mr. Wick was, he was saying, no, the jamming, the interference is very minimal. He says, it's coming in loud and clear, and I say, why then is Radio Marti trying to hire these local Miami radio stations, including Regalado Station, to reprogram Radio Marti programs into Cuba? So,
well... I mean, Wick didn't have anything to do with this in 91. I mean,
right, but he obviously didn't know. Just one last question now is that when Secretary of State Alexander Haig met secretly with Cuban Vice President Rodriguez in November 1981, was this sort of on his own initiative, or was this the president wanted him to do this, or what was behind this? Because here's a guy that's been saying, we ought to go to the source, we ought to do this, we ought to do that. And then he tries this secret rapprochement route, and that he even later sent General Walters on to expand.
Yeah, it's even worse, that's right, because in March of 82, well, I think it's all part of, again, this sort of particular style the Department of State has, that it tends to try to have backdoor negotiations and second tracks and so forth with foreign dictators, in imitation of Henry Kissinger. There's a specific desire to imitate that. And I can only tell you that when I learned of the clandestine meetings and brought it to the attention of members of the cabinet and then the president, it was stopped immediately.
The clandestine meeting with Rodriguez?
Yeah, well, no, with the whole sort of the whole negotiating trial that Haig had opened up. And at Ender's suggestion, I would imagine, he opened up a whole negotiating approach, which was kept secret, and I would argue was kept secret for most of the U.S. government, all of our allies in the region, and it was only the Cuban government that used the secret negotiations against the United States. See, what the Cuban government did was to say to friendly countries, you see, the United States hasn't told you about this, but we have these secret meetings. So you can't trust the United States. They're deviants, they're snakes. That's what we always told you. They'll always sell you out. So they're trying to sell you out right now. General Walters is in Havana talking to Castro. And you don't know about it, do you? And that's what they did. And when, as I say, I learned about this through our means, and once I learned about it and brought it to the attention of a member of the cabinet, who brought it to the president immediately told Haig to stop it. And once it stopped, it immediately helped things in the region.
So this was after the March 82 meeting? After the meeting of Walters with Castro and Rodriguez.
Well, that's right, but then there were no... Haig was ordered to stop that activity. And it was, I was going to say, I believe it was engineered, proposed by Enders, that Haig decided to do it. It was all very much, remember, they both worked for Kissinger. It was very sort of Kissingerian, very duplicitous of U.S. allies. You know, duplicitous of U.S. allies and solicitous of hostile dictators. A certain style of international politics. And it was not Reagan style when he found out about it, he stopped it. And then Haig was fired in June of 82, after he also then was being duplicitous of his president, and the president of the United States saw a tape recording of what Haig was telling other people to ignore the president that he'd just been with at a major summit meeting.
I'm in charge here.
I think presidents have enough. You know, there's a certain point where they really don't want members of their cabinet or sub-cabinet to undermine them.
To say, I'm in charge here.
Well, but you have to see, I think you have to see the Cuban policy of the Reagan administration in the context of two realities. One was the reality that the Soviet Union was heavily armed, perceived as highly dangerous, and a close ally of Castro, and therefore any actions of a military kind directly against Castro carried the risk of thermonuclear war, a risk not worth taking, since there were other means to accomplish the purposes of the United States in containing and ultimately defeating Castro. And the second reality is that the Reagan administration came to office with the Department of State dominated by career foreign service officers who had a policy view on a broad array of international issues opposed to Reagan's, and that they again and again and again worked to have their foreign policy views dominate in spite of the orders and written decisions of the president. And therefore, those who were on Reagan's side working to have the president actually governing foreign policy could only take on so many issues. There was a limited number of battles you could fight, and so some of the Cuban battles that might have been fought were not, because there were others that were more important.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mingus.
You're welcome.